Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 18th, 2015. Too many topics to cover tonight. Quickly, on tonight, June 18th, tomorrow the 19th, the 20th, look up in the western sky after the sun goes down, Venus, Jupiter, and the moon doing a little interjuxtaposition there in the western sky. And from what I understand, look also on the 30th of June. That's when Jupiter and Venus will be the closest, but by then the moon will have moved away. But interesting, that's always fun. Get out and look at the night sky. And then see if you can identify some constellations, get familiar with the night sky. Something actually I have been doing lately and trying to, I won't give specifics, but it's just something that everybody should do. It's fun, it's entertaining, and educational. And it gets you away from the standard in-the-house things, TV, video games, etc. This is a study that just came out. Stanford University has made a study, and what they're saying is that by 2050, that's 50 years earlier than the G7 meeting, who said that we should be off carbon fuels by the end of the century. What a joke. That's only 85 years away. The Stanford plan calls for 2050. That's 35 years away. Most people on the planet Earth will be dead by then. Anyway, it's so ridiculous how they come up with this. But they're saying to go to renewable energies. And I haven't looked at the entire study yet, which basically put numbers on the amount of energy used and the various types of energy and availability of various types of energy already existing, alternative energy, etc., in various states, in the 50 states. So in that respect, it's going to be a valuable plan, but that's something I'll probably use and build on just because, verify their numbers, of course, but verify that those numbers are actually valid. But there's a lot of holes here, too, because, for example, we heat right now with natural gas. It's a much better heating source than, for example, electricity. So the problem here is that you have to account for all of these converting to electric heat. Electric heat is very, very inefficient unless you have the, like one of my wing generators right on site. Then you'd be converting to electricity, and that would be going directly into the heating the house. And the wasted energy would actually be helping to heat your house, too, in the conversion between wind and electricity. But at any rate, I always find this comical, but they, of course, used standard solar, wind, etc. And I can see that just from the cursory study that I've done of this examination, that they really haven't done their homework on a true conversion, because although they do talk about converting gasoline into electric, there are better ways to do this, because conversion to electric and then electric back to power, like movement energy of motion, is not really efficient. There are more efficient processes that we're working on right now. My plan with the wing generator is 10 years, and that's starting right now, actually in the very near future, replacing some people, the smaller people, the island communities, the ranches, the farms, etc., and getting them completely off of the grid, getting them cutting the line to the central power company. And so, in fact, just kind of happenstance, I came up with a new term that I'm going to start using. And instead of alternative energy, I'm going to start calling my process, the wing generator, I'm going to start calling it replacement energy. The idea that when we think of alternative energy, we think of something, like a Band-Aid. Oh, it's a little bit of a help, yeah, isn't that great? Aren't we all feeling green and good about it? But the result is that it's really not a solution. It solidifies the central power company and its hold on you, because it's never going to be a solution. And so at any rate, my solution, the wing generator, is what I call replacement energy. it's literally to replace that central power company, and it's going to someday. We've already got a lot of progress. And by the way, I want to promote this. I have to blow my own horn on this. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on the link at the top of the page that takes you to the crowdfunding webpage, and make a contribution, $5, $10, $20. It's very easy to do. You can do it anonymously, or you can pick one of the perks and get something for your donation, kind of a gift. And also there's, at the bottom of the page, there's licensing for developers. Now, this is a very important part of crowdfunding and also the Wing Generation Project in general, that people have to understand that there's some people out there who would like to dabble in this. And so then they have a feedback process by which their contribution to the open architecture can come back. Other people can use it. Somebody might have a better idea for bearings. Somebody might have a better idea for how to tether the wings during high wind conditions, etc. So this is a composite effort, and nobody has all of the solutions. And so the Wing Generator Fundraising Project is to get the what I call the 12-meter commercial model on the market. This is going to be what I calculate the widest selling product in the world regarding the wing generator. So the bigger ones will sell less, and really will be less useful right now, because what you have to understand is there's no practical way to put energy back on the grid. The power companies can't handle it. Once you start generating serious amounts of power, they don't want it. They don't want to see you doing this. They're going to block it at all costs. So at any rate, what I'm proposing, therefore, is a solution that's big enough to manage a large ranch, a farm, an island community of 8 modern houses or 50 to 100 third world houses, etc. And so, at any rate, go to that webpage. It's explained there in detail. Put in a $5 or a $10 contribution, and some people are putting in more. Some people are 100, some 500. And so that makes up, and just think, well, you know, some people think, well, my $5 contribution isn't really going to do much. Really, it is, because it's a vote. It's looking at the number of people who have made contributions, and other people go there and they go, well, gee, this is succeeding. I want to donate also. So your $5 vote is very important in the crowdfunding world. And so once again, just go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, Cuba this week in the news, being considered right now the global leader in medicine. And a lot of this might come to as a surprise to a lot of people, but in medical research, in medicine, and in managing a national health program in which everybody has health care. Now, let's take it and look at the United States and compare it. The reason Obamacare has not succeeded, they only got the very low-end people, low-income people, to sign up, and those people are going to be the ones that use the majority of the services, so it's not going to work. It's putting a square peg in a round hole, because the U.S. health community and medical community is based on big money. A low-end paid doctor in the United States makes $700,000 a year. That's considered poor. Many just practitioners are making, in corporate hospital world, are making $1.5 million, $2 million a year. That's a lot of money for one person. But the problem is there's not enough money in the system for these kind of high costs when you mix in big pharma, cancer treatment, and the list goes on and on. Those are the biggies. So there's really not a lot left over for the person. Let's put it that way. Doctors are fleeing the U.S. system in droves. But let me go back 55 years ago to a guy named Dr. Ernesto Guevara. And so here is a guy who was instrumental. He was a doctor, a medical doctor, started out his career traveling around, dealing with poor people, severe poverty, I mean, I guarantee you, you people out there cannot imagine the level of severe poverty back in the 1950s in Latin America. And otherwise known as Che Guevara, gave a speech shortly, like 1 month after the Cuban Revolution, in Havana to the graduating class and to some other people of the medical school in Havana. And so what he was doing at that point was setting the new direction for medicine in Cuba, as they had to basically go out into this really big island. Cuba is a big island, in the severe poverty, and somehow manage without any resources. Because in what they did over the next 55 years is built up the best medical system in the world. The best students from Latin America go to that school. In fact, students from all over the world go to Cuba for free. The medical system is free, and I met a doctor from Cuba excuse me, in the last couple of years, and really analyzed the medical world. Now, this was a practitioner. This doctor was a practitioner. So I really got a firsthand look at what it's like to be a doctor in Cuba today. And now this doctor also then lived in the United States and happened to be in the state of Virginia when on Christmas Day, the neighbors across the street, a black family, were thrown out of their house by the local sheriff for foreclosure. And the doctor said this would never, ever happen in Cuba. People are guaranteed housing. People are guaranteed medical and dental. People have all their teeth in Cuba, including the older people, for the first time in some Latin American countries. Because of Cuba's medical program, people in other Latin American countries are seeing a doctor for the first time. So, you know, there's the story is so distorted in the United States, it is not funny. But at any rate, the Cuban national medical system, when the Ebola crisis struck in Africa, Cuba sent the most doctors there. Not the United States, Cuba, little Cuba, you know, smaller than Florida. You know, it's just unbelievable, the misinformation floating around. But going back 55 years, August 19th of 1960 was when Che Guevara gave his address. And if you want to see, and by the way, I have reproduced that on my webpage. Go to the right column of my homepage down at the bottom and click on the link. It'll take you to the official English translation of that speech. You should also listen to his speech to the United Nations at about the same time when he had to confront the capitalist countries of the West. And now you have to understand, capitalism, unbridled capitalism as it's practiced in the United States, is not a success. It's basically failing all around the world, as is dictatorial communism. Lenin-type communism doesn't work either. But you find that in Russia, the stories that are coming back from people that are traveling there say that it's an open country. People, you can walk up to the Kremlin. Hey, you know, there's Putin inside dealing with all the other issues of Russia. You can walk up and touch the Kremlin. There's no wired gate with security and super high security around it where you cannot get in and see or talk to the president. No, the people are walking around there, tourists, foreigners. You know, nobody's shooting Putin of these people. You know, it's the situation in Russia is so different than what is portrayed in the Western press. And if I have time at the end of the show, I'm going to talk about a lot of misinformation that's coming out about the Russian space program, primarily the Russian space shuttle, which was a huge success from about 88 to 1993 when due to Reaganomics, the Soviet Union had budget cuts in its space program. So they cut the shuttle, which was really the most expensive program they had. And it was very much a sideline of the Soviet space program. but there's some joker running around. He went over there, took some pictures, and he said, oh, the Russian space shuttle flew one time and didn't make it, and that was the end of the story, which is totally, totally false for anybody that knows anything about the Russian space program. The Russian space program is so far advanced of anything the United States has, including the Air Force, including everything they have in the military. This year, the United States doesn't even have a military presence at the Paris Air Show, which is beginning next week, from the June 17th to the 23rd. The Russians are dominating it with all of their military hardware, which is for sale on the open market worldwide. If you need a helicopter, you need some RPGs, how about some, a Russian advanced fighter plane, you can buy it at the Paris Air Show for sale. But the U.S. doesn't even have a presence there because they're so outgunned. Not Top Gun anymore. But just to close the comments on the Cuban medical system, in medicine, in terms of treating the public and public health care, medical research that is world class, including cancer research, cancer treatment, etc., and managing a national health care plan, all world spectacles in the limelight. And, compared to that to the United States, where health care is an absolute disaster, and this will come as a surprise to a lot of people, but when the housing crisis hit the United States, there was no housing crisis in Cuba. The medical plan, I'm not going to spend any more time on this show about that, but it's something that people have to start to understand the real story. Hurricane Bill coming in on Texas, Oklahoma, severe torrential rain, looks like really not a hurricane, but a tropical storm. I don't think it ever got even near hurricane status, but was able to pick up plenty of rain. Now, as we're hitting record heat temperatures in the American Southwest, California, etc., severe drought. Now, this just shows that they could bring rain into California and have it rain, etc. When the Hurricane Blanca came up the West Coast, it missed California. It dumped rain on the other states east of California, but it really missed California. So the drought continues there. But Tropical Storm Bill dumping tremendous amounts of rain, and is it a manipulated storm? My vote on that is an absolute yes. That they're pounding Texas, the eastern part of Texas being just with flash floods, etc. This is called weather bombing. It's what you do if you're softening a target. This is actually a military term. You're softening the target with carpet bombing in the old World War II scenario. In the modern scenario, you flood the area with weather bombing. So at any rate, Tropical Storm Bill, very definitely, in my mind, a manipulated storm. Also, I got a report. I didn't see this myself, but it sat offshore for 3 days as it accumulated water, and other reports of HAARP being very active above that region for that entire period of time. So, yeah, tropical storms don't just sit there. They move. They might move 5-10 miles an hour. But it sat there for 3 days, accumulating all the water that is now dumping up through the United States. Just a quick mention, water filters I have on my webpage, very unique. And so go there. All the information is there, jmccsci.com. And remember, I don't sell a stainless steel water filter with just 2 filter elements. They come with 4 filter elements. I wouldn't sell you just 2 filter elements any more than I'd sell you a car without a spare tire or a steering wheel. You need those extra ones, and you can also buy 10 packs. The new GF filters do not require add-on filtration. They contain all of the filtration you have to look at the list: pharmaceuticals, heavy metals, arsenic, chloride, chloramines, things that the add-on filters never thought about taking out. And so I still do sell the add-on filters. There's still some people that have a requirement for them if they say just have fluoride or something like that in their water, and they're just trying to get rid of that, or maybe a higher than average arsenic level in, say, a well water. But other than that, the main product is the GF filters, all in one filter element, no need for add-on. Okay, Pluto in the news. Oh my goodness, this came out this past week, and NASA didn't do their photoshopping before I caught this, but Pluto is showing cometary activity, and its moons, its five moons. I have captured this, I put it on my webpage, just scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the, basically it's a, like a multiple photo video of the moon circling, and you can see the comet activity, the swirling comet tail activity around Pluto. Now, NASA has not released any photos from the New Horizons space probe that's rapidly approaching Pluto. The last photos we have are from weeks ago when this information came out, and I found this very, very strange that a guy named Hal Weaver, he's a comet specialist, University of Hawaii, good old Hal, Ozzie Hainau, and Ollie Hainau, etc., over there, back from the old Hale Bob days. Now, these are the guys that were instrumental in doctoring the photos of Hale Bob to make it look like it did not have a companion. This hit the national news, and the my good friend Chuck Schrammick, now deceased, Courtney Brown also had a picture that he got from these guys and put it on the Art Bell page, and the rest is history. That's a very long story. Resulted in the so-called suicide of the Heaven Gates people. It was actually a mass murder set up by the people, because the people who were basically involved in Promise Software at the time. This is a very complicated story, and I've talked about this on my show. I will not talk about it again tonight, but Hal Weaver, astronomer royal from the University of Hawaii, is a comet specialist. Why is he in charge of the Pluto? I mean, this guy's top dog of the Pluto New Horizons mission. This is very strange. And then the pictures, as I said, turn out to have comet tail activity on them. That's something I noticed that's on my webpage. I encourage you to go see that. But no new pictures out for a couple weeks from that Horizon spacecraft. Do you think it's not taking pictures of Pluto every day, like a couple thousand a day possibly? Of course it is. And they're studying those, and they're baffled because there shouldn't be any cometary activity out as far as Pluto. I mean, the sun has no light, or the solar wind is very weak at that point. What Pluto is doing is discharging the local capacitor, the local solar capacitor. The nebular ion cloud is right there. Pluto is actually right on the inner skirts of it, so it has an abundant tail material for the discharge. And I discussed this on my webpage, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, scroll down and look at the write-up about Pluto. But this is getting very, very, more than very interesting. Now, also in the news, let me quick mention this. I see a little note up in the corner of my page on nuclear weapons proposal for using them to stop asteroids or comets that could potentially crash into Earth. And this leads also in, by the way, I'll be doing a Planet X update here in a couple minutes, but this leads into the same topic. There have been studies, think tanks that have gotten together and are recommending various programs in case there's a true asteroid threat to Earth. And they know, let's just say for a hypothetical example, someone knows that they're is going to be in a collision of an asteroid or comet nucleus with Earth, then what should we do? One of the proposals is nuclear weapons to blow it apart. It's been already recognized that that's really a terrible idea, because now you got a bunch of pieces that are separating, and now you're going to have all of these hitting Earth, probably big chunks. You cannot completely obliterate an asteroid. You might blow it into five smaller chunks. So not a good plan, but here's the other problem. Do you want these nuclear bombs just sitting around in a warehouse someplace with the amount of terrorism going on today and the lack of trust in government, in the military, in special interests, you know, people that can get their hands on these and divert them to other topics or get one and break it down into a bunch of suitcase bombs? No, this is a terrible idea simply because of the lack of control of nuclear weapons. It's a horrible idea. So what should we do if an imminent asteroid, and I'm not saying there is, I'll be getting to that entire topic in a minute, but what should we do? The best solution is basically what we call an ion engine or a heat engine, where you take, basically put a lander on it. The European Space Agency has already landed on a comet nucleus, so the technology, it's not a difficult technology at all. Land on the nucleus, burn off some material, put it into a rocket engine, and fire it in a direction so that this thing would miss Earth, and keep that going on. But here is also the problem. There is an enormous problem here in that, okay, let's just take a hypothetical scenario here, and let's also talk about Planet X, asteroids, and there's a million stories out there, people saying that in the fall of 2015, and I've heard all kinds of dates from early September to the into November that supposedly this is supposed to happen, and all's from so-called confirmed sources, etc. Let me just say, nobody on this planet that would be making such an announcement has access to, number one, the data that would give you position and velocity. That's the direction of the speed, the direction of the motion, etc., accurate enough to, and then also the computational capability with computers to calculate that this thing would hit Earth at a given time. Now look at how ridiculous some of these predictions are. They say a window from, say, September 24th to 28th. That's one that somebody sent in. And by the way, I have not seen any data. Let me just summarize right now. I have not seen any data that it has any value at all that would lead me to believe that any of these predictions have any validity at all. I have not seen any data, and I'm a scientist. That's what it requires. Not a wing thing on Google Map or Google Sky. Not somebody told me from high places in the military. I'm a scientist. I need data. If those people have real information, there's a standard format that this has to be presented in, a standard astronomical format, and it's not complicated. Amateurs can do it. So anybody who's high up in military or whatever that has this kind of information would have access to this type of data. Position, and not only position, but the velocity and motion and orbital data. Orbital data means then you can predict where this is going to go based on current information. Let me also throw in another little problem. When you're looking at that, say you have a telescope, automated search, you're taking readings of position and location, etc., that's not where the thing is, because the speed of light from something, say, out by Mars or near Mars or even, you know, halfway between Earth and Mars, when you're seeing that object, that's not where it is because of the speed of light. It's already moved in its orbit, so you have to make up for this, and that amount of time to get to Earth changes constantly as the object moves. So it's a very difficult problem to calculate and determine and measure the position and velocity of some object if you can see it. Plus you have distortion in the atmosphere. Plus you have other effects that are going on. And then to determine the velocity and orbital path of this to the point where you can calculate that it's going to hit Earth at a given time. Some people have said that, for example, I heard one, it's going to hit the eastern coast of Venezuela in a three-day period window. Well, the reality is, if they know it's going to hit the eastern coast of Venezuela, the Earth spins at that location at about 1,000 miles an hour. That means in a three-day window, Venezuela is going to go around the earth three times, you know, in 3 days. And if you want a window where it's going to hit by the coastline, then we're talking about a five-minute maximum window. That would mean if people had real information that it was going to touch the eastern coast of Venezuela, then they would be telling you something like a specific time, hour, minute, within a minute, probably a minute to 2 minute, plus and minus 2 minute time frame on a given day, etc. Not a 3 day window. I mean, it's so if you're a scientist and you understand these things, you can take this misinformation for what it is. It's just gobbledygook. I mean, these people simply don't know what they're talking about. They try and sound scientific, but they're not. And so the bottom line is that making these measurements is extremely difficult. And even if you're the military, with the instrumentation they have in Haleakala in Hawaii, the infrared telescopes, the visual telescopes, satellites in outer space, everything else, GPS to measure position, you know, the absolute calculation of something like hitting. Okay, imagine this. You have two guns that are lined up, kind of crossing paths, and you shoot a bullet with one. Okay, that bullet leaves the gun. Okay, now you're not aiming at a target. Now, here's your job. You have to measure the velocity and position of the bullet coming out of one gun. You have to measure this after it's left the gun. And then with the other gun, calculate where to point that, then calculate the velocity of that bullet, and have them meet. And not only that, but you want this to touch on a certain side of the bullet that's rotating. That's the equivalent problem in astrophysics and space science or in astronomy, to try and predict that something is going to hit Earth. Not only that, but as it approaches Earth, its orbit is going to change drastically, because now it's in the gravitational field of Earth and our moon, and its orbit is going to be bending. So it's not the orbit that you calculated before. You have to take into account the fact that Earth has a gravitational field working on this and changing its orbit. So if you only calculated the orbit based on where it was before, then and you thought it was going to hit Earth. Well, it's not going to hit Earth because it's interacting with Earth. These are extremely, extremely difficult problems, even for people with the best equipment who really know what they have, what they're doing, and have the computing power. Now, there's another problem with computational computing, in which it's called rounding errors. When you're doing this many calculations, including Jupiter and Saturn and all the other planets and the Sun and Earth and the Moon, and the differential fields, the fact that the Earth is not a perfect sphere, these are the kind of factors that have to come into play. In the military, what I'm talking about are rounding errors. When you make a calculation like an addition or a multiplication with large numbers, with large numbers of decimal points, significant decimal points after the decimal point, the rounding errors, what happens is you have to round off because your computer register is only so large. These are called rounding errors. And as you make more and more calculations, these rounding errors become significant. A number of years ago, scientists called what they did calculations, and they said, oh, all of the solar system orbits blow up into a chaotic fashion in a short period of time. Well, that's not true. It's not really what happens. What was going on is the rounding errors in their computers. They didn't understand this. These were tier two idiot scientists trying to do something that they didn't understand. Okay, so I won't talk about that anymore, but let me just put it this way. There is nobody who's making these predictions that has the ability to get that information, determine where these things are, and then calculate trajectories. And if they're comets, the drag of the tail is actually changing the orbit too. So these are extremely complicated things, and in some of those factors, you cannot predict. You cannot predict what the tail drag is going to be over the course of the lifetime of this comet. And certainly, out 3 months is far too long for the normal average person to even begin to predict. So that tells you right from the get-go that these, and no, this has been going on for decades, this kind of things that usually happens in May, but then we've seen this, May 15, 2003, crazy lady talks to aliens. Even she's back in the picture talking about Planet X crashing into Earth, etc. And so if anybody has somebody that they claim knows the real story, then they easily can put this on the internet, and I'll myself verify it if it's false or true, because I can see with my own equipment on a worldwide basis in both hemispheres, not a problem. But the people out there, the ding-dongs, the Marshall Masters, the crazy lady talks to alien Nancy leader, these people are a bunch, you know, how many 50 or more predictions Planet X is behind the sun or it's behind Jupiter. I mean, this is just really, and of course, this is being done to flood the public with misinformation. You have to understand that, to distract you, the public. Anyway, the bottom line is, I don't want to spend my whole show on this. Very simply put, anybody who has real information has to have it in a standard format, not just a picture that somebody says, oh, here's a picture, there's Planet X, it looks like a wing thing. Oh, I mean, the amount of garbage out there is just incredible. What you need is very simply put in standard astronomical format, which is well known to anybody that can wheel a small telescope around, the data, the position, the velocity, and the orbital parameters. Now, this is all well known. And without that, you don't have anything. It's like I use this example all the time. Somebody sends you a picture of a robin in the snow and says, this is a robin at the South Pole. Well, okay, that's somebody who claims that's a robin at the South Pole. What you see is a picture of a robin in the snow, something I've seen many times growing up in the upper Midwest. That's the picture of robin in the snow does not mean that that robin is at the South Pole. Okay? That's just somebody making a claim. To make it a scientific claim, you would need independent verification from legitimate groups and also reproducible data, something that people can verify. And with the case of astronomical events, this is something that anybody could verify if these people have information. Now, Planet X type objects can slip in on us, and I'm the one who's made this crystal clear. They can slip in on us. We've seen many, many comets come into the solar system completely unannounced and make it all the way to the sun before NASA even knows it's there. We've had many examples of this just in the last couple of years. But, there's many, many examples. There was a comet a couple of years ago that sat out, but right off of Jupiter in the night sky, and it wasn't discovered until it had sat there for really months. Finally, some amateur picked it up. I think that was one of the Comet McNaughts. But literally sat out there. Nobody noticed it. Of all the amateur comet hunters out there, finally somebody noticed it, and it had been sitting there the whole time. So these things can sneak in and sneak up on us, and they're not all visible. They can move in very fast. Big objects can move extremely fast, but the type of thing that, say, only NASA would know. But the bottom line is, if somebody has information, then that means it's now visible by a certain level of equipment. That's the other thing besides telling position, velocity, orbital data. Then you have to give the magnitude. In other words, what type of equipment is used? Is it infrared? Is it visible? Is it, how big is this? How bright is it? What's the magnitude of the object? That's all part of this data package. And I have not seen a shred of anything that would qualify as legitimate data. So that's the Planet X update. And there's, by the way, I was going to come out with another book information at this time, but I'm so involved in the wing generator project that I might just give a series of lectures and put them out there for free, because I'm so disgusted with all the people on the internet selling their whatever their wares or whatever it is, making planet X or asteroid predictions. Remember, I'm the only guy out there that I know of that is not making predictions. I do not make predictions. Everybody is trying to egg me on. Jim, give us some kind of prediction. Tell us something. You got to say something about Planet X or when it's going to be here or whatever. First of all, there are many, many, many Planet X objects. And the second is, I don't make predictions unless I would have real solid information. And I have yet to see any. Okay, on to the Rosetta mission. And oh my goodness, Comet 67P has been studied nose-to-nose with the Rosetta mission. The Philae, the lander, woke up this past week, phoned home, and is now in. They're now in communication. There was just a video released at the Paris Air Show from the staff, the head staff of the Comet Lander mission, the Rosetta mission. And at minutes, 1 hour, let me get the time stamp here for you. You can find this. It's the Paris Air Show video. I'll try and put this link on my page. But at 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 52 seconds into this, the lead scientist blatantly says, he says, when the last 10, 20, 30 years, the last number of decades, the standard nomenclature for a comet was dirty snowball. He actually said ice ball, which dates him. He was an older guy, and that's back in the early days. They called it the dirty ice ball, and then it changed to dirty snowball, but this was all the Whipple model that came out of the 1950s when the standard scientific community didn't have an explanation for what a comet was. Velikovsky was challenging and saying, hey, these comets are becoming planets, and the astronomical community literally did not have a theory for what a comet was. They thought it might be a dust cloud, or they thought that there might be rock changing into water. They really didn't know. They didn't have an idea of what this might be. And so they came up with the Whipple Dirty Snowball Comet model, and he lived his whole life as a famous astronomer on completely incorrect information. The original idea came from Kepler in the Middle Ages, who was the first guy to realize that comets are not the Aristotelian thought of the in the atmosphere, fire in the atmosphere, but that the comets were actually out there in orbit around the sun in elliptical orbits. He discovered Halley's Comet, and the etc. Was the first one to really understand the repetition that these comets can come back, and there certain years would be the same one, tracked it way back into the early Middle Ages, etc. But the point is, at 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 52 seconds into the European Space Agency release information at the Paris Air Show, he comes out and he says, look, you know, and he admits that he wrote papers quoting the dirty snowball comet model, etc., and he says what they know now is that comets are not dirty snowballs, that concept is completely incorrect. And I was going to try and play this for you, but my equipment here, the sound is too weak coming off the feed on that video for me to reproduce it on this show. So unfortunately, but basically I'll just paraphrase it the best I can. He said, they know now for a fact that the dirty snowball comet model is incorrect. And then they follow up by saying that the nucleus is covered with super black material that's made of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. They find no water or ice, and they have now dug down into, when the Philae, the lander, landed, it blew up some dust because they now can see, and some of that accumulated into the tubes where they had mass spectrometers to measure the characteristics of the volatiles and dust, etc. And so they now know that the vast majority of material on the surface of the comet nucleus, and it's completely covered in this, is a form of hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen compound. And by the way, these are the building blocks of life. These are the basic atomic components of the nucleotides of DNA. And so there's abundance of this, but of course then they back off and they say, well, this must have formed at the original time of the solar system formation 4.5 billion years ago, and they just turn the left corner into simple Simon silly science pronto in the interpretation of the data. And of course this is indicates to me that these are pure tier 2 scientists. They have no clue what they're looking at. The Rosetta spacecraft is totally incorrectly designed to look at a plasma discharge comet. There's no electric sensors. They don't talk about the magnetic fields at all. There's another result that just came out this past week regarding Rosetta, and this was very interesting. They basically confirmed everything I have said that you would find around comet nuclei. They found the hydrogen. What they were looking for water, expecting to find water that would be coming off the nucleus. But all they're seeing are individual atoms of hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And so these are the big four. These are the big four species that make up, I mean, when you look at organic molecules, these are the basis. And so the ammonias, just a long laundry list, the carbon-oxygen molecules, the carbon-hydrogen molecules, the hydrocarbons, and this is what they're seeing, the black hydrocarbon dominates in the coloration, so the comet nucleus is just pitch black. And so finally they've gotten down to the comet nucleus and they're saying, hey, ain't no water here. And by the other thing that they're not really quite saying yet is that they're seeing the pits, and the pits are where, now the pits are full of this dust material that really what is happening is this is forming in the tail as the atomic species come in under the electric field of the comet nucleus, as explained in my plasma discharge comet model, in the discharge of the solar capacitor. This material is forming. These are the chemical constructs that are building up from those four atomic species. And so they build up into this pulverized black dust that's blacker than, they say, is blacker than the moon, which is very, very black. By the way, which is one of the dichotomies, I'm not going to go into that stupid lunar landing deal, Apollo, it's just more ridiculous. But the lunar surface is very black, very, very black. And so the surface of the comet, they say, is three times more black. They say that the albedo of the comet is 5%. In other words, 5% of the light that reaches it from the sun is reflected. The rest is simply absorbed. So this is very black material. And so, but in the vicinity of the comet nucleus, they're not seeing any water, and they're confused. And they're so what they're saying is, ultraviolet light breaks down the water. Then there's a transfer of proton, and an electron comes off one of these water species, goes and hits another non-water single atomic species and causes it drops down in the energy levels of that atom and creates the characteristic spectrum. And so this is the scenario they put together, but they're not detecting any water coming off the surface, which was their big thing. They were also expecting carbon dioxide to be one of the big impetus to push dust off the surface. But they can see this dust in the vicinity of the comet nucleus, but they're not sure why it's there. But this is not the species of dust that you find out farther in the comet tail. This is forming down in closer to the nucleus and then falling down, being absorbed and falling down onto the comet nucleus, kind of like a fine snow. And, of course, this happens over a period of time. The dust that's in the comet tail that you see is more due to literally dust, the kind of dust you sweep up off your floor. But as this dust comes in and meets the electron beam, it gets basically pulverized, basically still the same constituent, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. And so anyway, they also are seeing the electrons, and this is the electron cloud that I say exists around the comet nucleus, because the comet nucleus is in it's part of the discharge of the solar capacitor, the electron beam from the sun being the primary charge carrier. And as the electron beam comes in and sees that negative charge that's building up like a rock builds up pressure in a stream, there's builds up a negative charge buildup around the comet nucleus. So you have an electron cloud that's basically hovering around the comet nucleus, and especially right behind the nucleus on the anti-sunward side. So this is all in my model. And then the hydrogen, the hydrogen molecule, the dual hydrogen, two hydrogen atoms in a molecular form, ionized, forms a cloud around the comet nucleus out to great, great distances, and that's the shielding. That's the primary shielding. Other species are also ionized, forming other clouds of shielding within that. But at any rate, you can see all of this, but that's why I say the Rosetta mission is totally, totally and properly designed for what they're expected to see. They should be witnessing this hydrogen cloud that's around the comet nucleus. They say nothing about that. They don't say anything about the discharge of the type 1 and type 2 tails. They don't say anything. All they're talking, they're concentrating on the molecular species that they find in around the comet nucleus, and they are not seeing water. So they're hypothesizing, mind you. They're hypothesizing that the water is broken up into individual components, oxygen and hydrogen, and then the spectrum that they're seeing, which is of atomic hydrogen, atomic oxygen, or molecular hydrogen, molecular oxygen, by themselves, not in the form of water, but simply hydrogen, oxygen, that they're seeing the spectrum of those individuals, and they're saying, oh, well, that must be because the water's breaking up. So that's a projected concept based on the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which they just said is totally false. So they don't know what they're looking at. They're scratching their heads. You can kind of see they're really trying to scratch body parts here to figure out what's going on. But they have to revert back to this, oh, it happened 4.5 billion years ago stuff. And they're making all kinds of wild projections, like this is where life on Earth came from and this is where we came from. That is so far-flung, fetched from what the data they're looking at here that it's not even funny. So anyway, a lot of comet activity in the news. Pluto, the comet 67P with the Rosetta mission. It's very interesting to see all of this happening. But every step of the way, remember a number of weeks ago on my show, I said they are going to discover comet activity at Pluto. And so in fact, they have discovered it. I'm just going to give a quick review of the Paris Air Show coming up here. Starts the 17th. That was yesterday. So up to the 23rd, a big international event. The U.S. tried to build a Paris Air Show type of event. I attended that back in the 1980s. I forget. I think it was around 1983 out in San Diego, the San Diego Airspace America Air Show, and I think it kind of fizzled. I mean, it's hard to compete, hard to have two major air shows during the year, and the Paris Air Show has traditionally been the big one. So just at any rate, the Boeing Dreamliner, the Airbus 350 and 380 making a big appearance there. The Airbus 350 and 380, the Boeing Dreamliner is making an appearance there. I believe it's just going to be a flyover. The paint is hardly dry on it, and lots and lots of military hardware. And basically, the Russians have a lot of equipment there. I think there's some Bell helicopter from the United States has a presence there. But basically, the U.S. Air Force does not have any real presence there at all, including the F-35, which is the new, supposedly hottest fighter off the assembly line. In the United States, will not be there. Totally outclassed by the Russian Su-35S, which is their latest fighter plane that can do somersaults around anything the U.S. has. I certainly wouldn't want to be a U.S. pilot. The Russian fighter can, at 11-kilometer altitude, can go 2,400 kilometers per hour. You know, so this thing is faster than a speeding bullet. The U.S. really being on the high end, really totally outgunned by foreign aircraft. And, of course, like I said earlier in the show, the Paris Air Show is where you can buy anything military under the sun. So if you need your local militia, if you need a jet or other aircraft, go to the Paris Air Show. You can buy it there. Also, the GE, the General Electric 9X commercial aircraft engine on display there, new generation, highly efficient. And they upgrade these every couple of years. This one, I believe, is destined for the Boeing 777 fleet, the newer, more economical jets that are the big ones, the big jets that are coming online. But a lot of Tier 2 technology. Now, remember that in a real shooting war, if we had real technology, none of this would even be visible. There are far advanced technologies behind the scenes in the Skunk Works and Tier 1. But see, that isn't, you think, well, gee, why doesn't the United States get this stuff out? And if we went to war, we'd win in a heartbeat with no problem. The reason is because warfare is strictly Tier 2. And the equipment that's being sold, we sell off all of our old stuff to all kinds of other countries. This is big business. And so the whole reason for Tier 2 technology for warfare is that you have a balance between the sides. And that's what keeps the bankers in charge. All of this is this warfare stuff and the boogeyman and ISIS and the Taliban and... the Shah of Iran, let's go back 20, 30 years, back in, all of the various groups, the Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, these are all CIA constructs to keep the world on edge and at odds with each other. And within that environment, the world bankers are successful. So anyway, that's what the Paris Air Show is about, to keep that going. And of course, it's you got to play on the greed of everyone. Lots and lots of people make lots and lots of money. The Devil's Workshop really, really doing well these days. A quick note on the Einstein letters, 62 letters handwritten by Albert Einstein during his life. And I'm not sure, I didn't read enough to find out where these letters came from, but they were auctioned off this past week, $420,000 total sale price at an auction for the personal letters, 62 personal letters of Einstein, some of them to friends, some of them regarding scientific issues or related, one relating special relativity to the atomic bomb. And of course, that's the famous E equals MC squared that just is very, if you understand special relativity in the mathematics, it just falls out. It's like you're doing the mathematics and blink, out falls this equation. But anyway, the Einstein letters, $420,000, I guess proving also that there's still people out there with change in their pocket. I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. Remember, go to the website, jmccsci.com, and donate. This is on the road. It's going to happen, so I want you to become part of it. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.